And we were talking about the Cold War. We were talking about the proxy wars that went on between the United States and the Soviet Union. That's what it is. And where did these proxy conflicts go on? Well, there was the Korean War, which you may have heard of. And that's one of your test terms. That's what it is. And when you see the president at the time was Harry Truman. Okay, the he had been Franklin Roosevelt's vice president. That's fine. And Franklin Roosevelt, as I mentioned earlier in the semester when I was talking about Washington and setting the precedent of for everything, and he only was president for two terms, so everybody else followed it. I mentioned to you that Franklin Delano Roosevelt broke that tradition. He ran again and again and again for a fourth term. He was in office, and then he died in office. And I said, after that, we made a rule. No more by tradition. This is absolute legal. You can only serve for, you can only run for two terms and serve for two terms. You have Harry Truman was Franklin Roosevelt's vice president. And so he became president. And it was actually him who made the decision to drop those atomic bombs. So Franklin Roosevelt doesn't even live entirely through World War II. Well, that's fine. World War II is over, as I said, and there's all these different nations that have become free. Well, one of them is Korea. Korea is south of China, attached to China, shares a huge border with China. And the Japanese had taken it over before World War II, before World War I, frankly, just before World War I. But they lost, Japan lost, Germany lost, this is what it is. All of their non-indigenous people territories are taken away from them, even if they didn't take it during World War II. Gone. So Korea, which was under Japan, no longer under Japan. Well, now what kind of government is it going to create? Again, you've got the Soviet Union on one side and us on the other, and it's already started to be that we're vying for power against each other. Neither side trusts the other. And so to make it fair, in Korea, they said, let's just cut it right in half. Korea is also a peninsula, like Florida, like Italy. It's a peninsula. And therefore, it's better to just cut it halfway up and down rather than side to side. And so they did. They broke it North Korea and South Korea. Just like if you did Florida, you wouldn't do it East Florida and West Florida. You do it North Florida and South Florida because it's a peninsula. It's mainly north-south, not east-west. So that's fine. And they decided on a halfway point. Basically, even the people who drew it up will tell you it was a somewhat arbitrary line. They definitely wanted halfway through, but they somewhat arbitrarily chose what's called the 38th parallel. You will hear that term a lot whenever people talk about the Korean War, which again is one of your textbook terms. But it's roughly halfway. And what is a parallel? Well, what happens is, just like anything, you see the world is divided up. You have to divide it up to make it manageable. If you see when you're making a city, usually you divide it up into a grid. You have blocks and stuff like that. In the history of Florida, when I do that lecture, I explain there when they were drawing up the plans for it, Coral Gables, they made a blue line with a blue pencil, or was it a blue pen? Well, a blue line, and they made a red line to break the city up into parts. And to this day, if you go there, it's Blue Road and Red Road, if you know those places. Now, you divide up the world, you have latitude and longitude. That's how they drew that up. Now, it's misleading if you look at a map. That shows it as a grid of squares, but if you see it on a globe, you'll get a better picture. Latitude, which is side to side, the lines that go side to side, those are parallel to each other. Longitude is different because the Earth spins. It's not practical, it's pointless, frankly, to do parallel lines. So just a side note, but the latitude lines are parallel and the longitude lines are not. It's a pretty interesting story about how that came about and everything, but I mean, the idea of this is you break things up to make them manageable. That's another thing you can really get from the note-taking as it becomes more and more sophisticated. You know, there's so many things here. And before we spend the rest of his lecture talking about these wars, I just, you know, this just came to my mind. If I didn't mention it earlier, one of the many, many, many benefits of doing the notes is when you do it regularly, you start to coordinate your mind and your writing. That's what happens. You get to be able to control one with the other. It's sort of like, and I may have mentioned this, there's this old running trick. If you want to run faster, move your arms faster. Even though you're not running on your hands, there's a direct connection between one and the other. If you want to, and same thing when I said the government controls the economy through money. It can't control the economy directly, but it can control the money, which controls the economy. When you see, if you want your cardiovascular conditioning to improve, you can't really control your heartbeat. You can't make it speed up and slow down. I mean, some people have impressive control over it, but basically, you can't do that. What you can do is control the rest of your body and make it run or jump rope or do a swim, whatever it is, and that will control your heart. And that's how you can make your heart go faster or slower and everything like that. When you get used to this note-taking, I was against it. I was really against it in high school and everything like that, and the lecture method is stupid and this and that. But really, really, there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it. And you'll be able to, even though you can't control your feelings and your mind necessarily, you can't stop yourself from worrying about something or being whatever, you will gain that control by gaining control over your note-taking. You're indirectly gaining control over your mind, over your thoughts. That's one of the reasons why I would say, you know, no cell phone use in class, no matter what, because that's short-circuiting the thing. Instead of learning to be in the moment, we're actually learning the opposite. We're learning to not do that. Instead of conditioning yourself to give 100% to whatever you're doing, whatever that may be, just whatever that is, 100% doing that, nothing else. You know, in fighting and everything like that, I've been training martial arts for at least 15 years, on and off, and probably longer than that. And, you know, I've trained at boxing gyms, I've trained at this, Muay Thai, whatever it is. But, you know, this one great thing I heard about how to, when you punch someone, I don't want you to punch him, I want you to kill him. That's what it is. Every single thing you've got into every punch you're making. When you kick him in the stomach, whole different training area, whole different teacher and everything like that. This was outstanding advice. When you kick him in the stomach, I don't want you to kick him in the stomach. I want you to break through his spine and come out the other end. When you kick him in the stomach, I want you to literally be listening to hear his spine shatter. That's how I want you to kick him in the stomach. And really, that's how I want you to do me. I want you to do everything. You don't have to do that every time, but you want to develop that ability. If you can do more, you can always do less. But push for greater and greater and greater ability. And mind you, this is not just to hurt people. Anything you use, another thing you get from history, anything you can use to hurt, you can use to help, and vice versa. When you see, you know, one of my teachers, I would always see him carrying this huge, sometimes even huge piles of stuff. He would only carry it in one hand, in his left hand. Why is that? To condition himself, he would always have his good hand free to attack or whatever it is. But frankly, it's also there to help himself or other people. And that's what it is. You know, as the saying goes, it's hard to help someone on shaky ground when you're on shaky ground yourself. And, you know, a lot of you and a lot of us human beings, we get by. We'll be able to get by. That's fine. But, you know, what happens if something goes wrong? Not only in our lives, but what if something goes wrong in somebody else's lives, other people's lives, a loved one, whatever it is? Do we have that extra to spare in terms of money, in terms of energy, in terms of whatever. So anyway, I had to say that about the note-taking and everything. Now, you guys have no idea how much stuff I've cut out of these lectures. Even when I do that History of Florida thing, when I make that explanation about the red and the blue, I say, oh, and to this day, there's actually a restaurant where those two roads meet called the Purple Point. Has anybody eaten there? Nobody says, yeah. And I say, oh, that's because I made it up. It doesn't exist. And then I say, well, actually, the restaurant does exist. It's not on any map, but it goes by the name Yayo. So if you guys just drive around Miami at night asking, where can I find Yayo? I'm looking for Yayo. I promise you a very exciting evening. If you get lost, ask a cop. You guys don't do that. You guys listening at home, don't do that. So, no, but anyway, I mean, it's been a tough semester all around, and we've all had to make adjustments and everything to lectures, to this, to that, but let us move on. Don't want to make some of these jokes here because I don't know if somebody's actually going to believe that and go out and do that, asking for yayo and everything, but now let's get back to the war and the Korean War. Now, mind you, these wars, which I'm going to talk about now, are far less consequential than World Wars I and II, but they certainly need to be noted, especially in American history. And what exactly happens? So you have this area here, Korea. The communists get the north. The non-communists get the south. And that of course, makes sense. North Korea's border is all along the line of China's border, and slightly, a little bit of it touches the Soviet Union's border. So Soviet Union's communist, China went communist, that made perfect sense. But what happens is, even though the communists agree, yeah, that's what makes sense, there are far fewer people in North Korea than in South Korea. About maybe one-third is in North Korea of the population, and two-thirds are in South Korea. So certainly, they don't want free and fair elections, because the majority of people live in a non-communist section. So the communists don't want to allow that. The Soviet Union does not want to allow that. And don't get it confused. We are strongly against communism at that time. I mean, massively, massively against communism. But China and the Soviet Union have serious problems with each other. They definitely do. And in fact, the Soviet Union kind of wanted North Korea to be a check against communist China. And they wanted a unified Korea as well, just like the West, but the Soviet Union wanted it unified under their rule, under their influence, I should say, and communist. So this was a serious issue. Now, the South Koreans, they eventually mobilized their military. North Koreans reacted to that, mobilized their military, and invaded South Korea. This was in 1950. Truman thought, and by the way, the North Koreans were pretty effective. They were really mopping the floor with the South Korean forces. In America, President Truman, okay, this is violating the containment policy. This is time to apply the containment policy. And Truman mobilized American forces and sent them over along with some United Nations forces to check this invasion. So Truman sends these forces, and it's basically American forces, completely basically, but it's under the United Nations, under the umbrella or under the cloak of United Nations. And although the president doesn't have the ability to declare war, exactly, you know, literally the president can't take the country to war. He has to get approval from Congress. In essence, he can send troops when there's some emergency or something like that. He can, in fact, in reality, for 90 days or so, there's a lot that he's able to do. Now, by this time, North Korea has taken almost all of South Korea. But then this UN Army, United Nations, mainly Americans, unified with the South Koreans, working with the South Koreans, stopped their advance, and then it's under the command of General Douglas MacArthur. He launches this brilliant amphibious attack at a place called Incheon, I-N-C-H-O-N. Essentially, as I said, it's a peninsula. Imagine here we're fighting in Miami, both sides, north against south, and then the southern forces sail around using the ocean and land in, let's say, Boca Raton, and then attack southward. The forces, the enemy forces, would be hitting, we'd be hitting them straight up from the south, and our forces which landed in Boca Raton would be hitting them from the north in a sandwich, in a vice grip to destroy them. So they're suddenly fighting a two-front war from both sides, and it is really, really effective. The North Koreans managed to attack. Retreat. Sorry about that. Jeez. Okay, let me just clarify this again. Basically, you have the Americans and the South Koreans. They're fighting the North Koreans in the South. But MacArthur, who's in charge of this force of the Americans and South Koreans, he launches this amphibious attack that lands behind the enemy North Koreans. And that so overwhelms the North Koreans retreat and retreat and retreat. And then MacArthur has pushed them back to the 38th parallel. So the lines have been restored. However, MacArthur asks President Truman, can I push further? You know, they started it. Let me finish it. Truman says yes. And then he keeps pushing them further and further into North Korea. So the South Koreans and Americans under MacArthur are pushing them further and further north. But what did I say was at North Korea's northern border? It's mostly China. And the Chinese sent word to us, what are you doing? You're getting closer and closer to our country. You need to stop. And we just kept going and going and going. When we got up to what's called, when we got near the Yalu River, we didn't get up to it, which is really the border with China. We get close to it. The Chinese attacked across the border because we were right, really, really close to their border. They were concerned about an invasion and other things. And this was bad. So the Chinese troops drove MacArthur and his forces back. And it finally stabilized back again, basically at the 38th parallel. And MacArthur kept arguing, no, let's bomb China. Let's bring in the forces from Taiwan. Remember I told you the anti-communist forces in China retreated off the mainland to the island that became known as Taiwan. So MacArthur is saying, no, let's bring all these forces in. And Truman said, no, we are not going to expand this war. This is, we will wind up basically at war with China, which is this gigantic country, and maybe even wind up at war with the Soviet Union. This is terrible. And MacArthur is just insisting on it. He even had really serious plans dropping, the point is, without opening up a whole can of worms here, MacArthur really took issue with it and publicly disagreed with the president. Now, this may not seem like much to you guys, but that is absolutely unthinkable. Unthinkable. This is at a point where Truman was at a low point in his popularity, extremely low point, and Douglas MacArthur was the most popular he had ever been, especially after this Incheon landing. But the military does not get to criticize the civilian leadership, not while they're in uniform. If they want to do that, they can put down the uniform, just like the presidency. As you guys may know, we have had a number of presidents who are formerly in the military. We have never had a president who is in the military, because that is not allowed. We learn very quick, just like the ancient Rome, our founding fathers knew, when you let the military rule the country, you have a very serious threat to freedom. One or the other, not both. And here, Truman actually fired MacArthur, and even Truman's strongest opponents didn't say a word against him. because the military, this is not some banana republic. You know, I mentioned with World War II, all these attempts against Hitler to kill him, Operation Valkyrie, most important. Now, German generals were revered in Germany, highly, highly revered. But the thing is, when they tried to kill him and when this plot was revealed, the people did not side with the German military. You would think they would think, oh, man, there must be something wrong with Hitler if all these military leaders want him dead. No. This is not some banana republic where the military overthrows the constituted leader. Nobody voted for them to run the country. And it's a very, very serious thing. So MacArthur gets fired, and there's eventually, you know, as I say, the 38th parallel. And in 1953, they had negotiated an armistice and signed it. So not a peace treaty, but basically a ceasefire, just like I said at the end of World War I. But that armistice is what has existed to this day. They never really made peace. It's always been a ceasefire. And you had over 50,000 Americans dead, many more than that wounded. But and you're back at the same place where you started from. However, it was hardly a failure. I mean, they repelled the North Korean invasion. In other words, the policy of containment was successfully applied and avoided World War III. So by that measure, it was a success. Now, that was 1953 was the armistice, and Truman, he does not run for re-election. Truman was a Democrat, just like Franklin Roosevelt. And his successor loses to General Dwight Eisenhower, very famous from World War II, huge hero. And it's not a coincidence. As I say, you know, this is not, once you see things, as you guys probably see it, even without my saying it, it's not a coincidence that the presidency moves in the way it does. You had George Bush Sr., and he was a Republican, and he focused very well on foreign policy and everything like that. He lost to Bill Clinton, who was a Democrat who focused more on domestic affairs, everything like that. Next, you had George W. Bush, George Bush Sr.'s son, and then people were very unhappy with that way of doing. We were in the Iraq War and everything like that. People were very unhappy. And after George Bush, there was a Democrat, you know, so it keeps going back and forth. So people were unhappy with George W. Bush. It's not a coincidence that Barack Obama came after him. You know, it's very unusual. In fact, it's unique to have a black man as president. And even then, remember, he was half black, Barack Obama. He had a white mother. But people were unhappy with Barack Obama. With the Affordable Health Care Act and this and that, government expansion, everything like that. So it's not a coincidence that after that we got another extreme, Donald Trump. So this is the way things work. And with Harry Truman, here you have the people dissatisfied with the way things are going, with the military performance. We have they were somewhat dissatisfied, but they were more so concerned about this communist threat. And so who better to lead the country? Who better to shepherd the country through this difficult, dangerous, the military dangers out there? Who better than Eisenhower? Not just a military general, not just a general of World War II, but one of the absolute most important ones. So he becomes president. Now, as I said, 1953 was this armistice, and then you... What happened here? All right. Now, this is good. Okay. Yeah, forgive me, this cord sometimes gets loose, or I accidentally touch the surface of the phone, and this and that. Okay, now, 1954, what's going on here? Well, Vietnam in Southeast Asia, the French had colonized them in the 1860s, so long, long ago, 1860s. They were, you have this French colony, basically... Vietnam ruled by the French for a long time, but by 1945, with all this talk of nations deciding their own fate, you know, after World War II, the Vietnamese leaders came and said, no, we want to be independent as well, and brought a petition and everything like that, but no one would hear it. No Western leaders would hear it. So they went to the communists, and the communists were much more receptive. And so that's how they were communist. And they these freedom fighters in Vietnam, and they wanted the French out. Now, 1954 is this date I keep mentioning because Eisenhower is approached with this idea, let's bomb these communist positions. Let's bomb their areas of strength and everything like that. Eisenhower said, instead of having the Air Force bomb these positions, why don't we just separate, divide Vietnam into the northern position for the communists, for the pro-communists, and the southern position for the pro-Westerns. And that is what wound up happening. At an international conference, they set the border at the 17th parallel. That's how they divided Vietnam, because Vietnam, although not a peninsula, it still was very north-to-south oriented, extraordinarily north-to-south oriented, so it made sense to divide it between north and south. And the north part shared a big part of itself with China's border. So North Vietnam shares a big border with China. China's a very large country, okay? Vietnam and Korea don't touch, but they both share large borders with China in the north. And so the north was for the communists. Well, that's fine. That's in 1954. Now, when you look 10 years after 1954, for whatever reason, 10 years later, it was 1964. This year, this 10 years thing keeps popping up in history for some reason. You have the United States, which has been supporting the South, okay, has been supporting the South Vietnamese. And even before that, just so you know, when it was a French colony, after World War II, the French were having problems with these freedom fighters in Vietnam. We were helping the French with money, ammunition, and even people, not just observers. We sent our troops to assist. And they were supposed to only be military advisors, but they sometimes even participated in some of these attacks, helping the South Vietnamese and everything like that. Now, part of that assistance is in the form of intelligence, and part of that intelligence comes from these Navy ships. One Navy destroyer, one of those Navy destroyers, was called the Maddox, M-A-D-D-O-X. And it was in a place called the Gulf of Tonkin. One of your textbook terms is Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. And there was a conflict with it and some North Vietnamese torpedo boats. Those torpedo boats were made by the Soviet Union, of course, not by the North Vietnamese themselves, but and there was some conflict there. Fine. The Maddox did substantial damage to the enemy and came out pretty much unharmed with basically zero damage. Next day, a second destroyer was sent in. I believe it was called the Turner Joy, and it's to reinforce the Maddox. Now, during this original confrontation, we had been supporting some South Vietnamese boats doing raids against North Vietnam's position. Again, now this next day, the two destroyers, the Maddox and the Turner Joy, were supporting more raids against the North Vietnamese positions. The ships report that, oh, all of a sudden, they have enemy boats firing massive amounts of torpedoes at them, dozens of torpedoes at them. And so in response, President Johnson orders airstrikes, direct U.S. airstrikes, not supporting the South Vietnamese doing it, U.S. directly airstrikes against North Vietnamese boat bases and stuff like that. However, what it turned out is there was no attack in this way. Firstly, what was not revealed to the public was that, yeah, we weren't just there harmlessly cruising by. Both these times we were supporting attacks on the North Vietnamese. And secondly, this second attack, the one that actually got us into Vietnam directly rather than just supporting the South Vietnamese. Never even happened. We have, it was declassified in 2005, that the overwhelming evidence at the time, even though there was confusion, I mean, even behind the scenes, we weren't sure what happened. And people suspected, you know, President Johnson and everything suspected that no, this wasn't a real attack. They just made a mistake. But in 2005, it was declassified that actually the evidence had been fully manipulated to make it look like the two ships were attacked. But in fact, they just mistook some sonar pings off of the American ships themselves. So in 1964, you have that textbook term, Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. What that is President Johnson goes to Congress and says that I need authority to go and respond in case anything happens in Vietnam. And he asked for unlimited authority to defend American forces in that area, and Congress gave it to him. And what happens is he winds up escalating and escalating and escalating massively more troops, hundreds of thousands of troops going into Vietnam, American troops. We wind up being there for 10 years. Now, Johnson, his term would end in 1969, and he was planning on running for re-election. But the war was just so controversial. So many people protested and everything, especially after what's known as the Tet Offensive, which is another textbook term of yours, the Tet Offensive. What on earth is that? Well, we keep adding more and more and more troops into Vietnam. This is going on year after year. And the government keeps telling Americans we're right on the brink of victory. They're about to collapse and everything like that. And America's, all right, well, you know, we don't want to be there. We're not sure why we're there. This is on the other side of the world. And, you know, we know that the South Vietnamese people don't like the South Vietnamese government. They don't want that government. So what are we really doing over there? The people we're supposedly protecting don't want this government. But anyway, okay, they're going along. We're on the brink of victory, everything like that. And what happened is Tet is the Vietnamese New Year, time of celebration, everything like that. But what happened is instead of celebrating, they launched massive attacks everywhere in Vietnam, everywhere in South Vietnam. And even though eventually we were able to fight them off, fight them back, this really, really turned American opinion, a lot of Americans' opinion, against the war. At that time, you had hawks and doves. A dove is a bird that is a symbol of peace, and hawks are like hunters and everything like that, so that symbolizes war. And even to this day, we still use those terms when we talk about how people view a certain war or a certain conflict. You have hawks about Iraq, and you have doves. But anyway, that was Johnson, whose term was supposed to end in 1969, and the Tet Offensive was in 68. And really, it is the Vietnam War. That was the reason why Johnson decides not to run for re-election. And another person becomes president, Richard Nixon. So here, just to keep this straight in your head, you had Herbert Hoover going way, way back to the 1920s, end of 1920 and early 1930s. You had Herbert Hoover, very unpopular because he did nothing during the recession. You had Franklin Delano Roosevelt, completely the opposite. He had big plans with the New Deal and everything like that, massive government expansion, and he's president for a long time, all the way to the end of World War II, just before it ends, 1945. Then his vice president takes over because Roosevelt died, and then Truman takes over. So he finishes FDR's term, and then he runs for one re-election and wins, but doesn't... I shouldn't have said re-election. Truman was president because the actual president died, and Vice President Truman then became president. After that term was over, what FDR's term, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's term, Truman runs his first election for president and wins. Then he doesn't run for re-election. So he served the remainder of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's term when Franklin Delano Roosevelt died. Then he served one term of his own where he won election, and then he doesn't run for a second time. I told you after that is Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, and then we come to 1961, you have John F. Kennedy, who is president. You've all heard of John F. Kennedy, and you know what happened to him. He was assassinated. And his vice president was Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson takes over, and he does, like Truman, he serves the rest of the president's term. When Kennedy dies, Johnson becomes president and serves the rest of that term, and then he gets elected on his own for a full term. Then he doesn't run for re-election. He was going to, but this Vietnam War has made him so unpopular, he doesn't do it. Then you have Richard Nixon, who becomes president. Again, you have now, it went from the Democrat, Lyndon Johnson, to Republican, Richard Nixon. Very aggressive, anti-communist, everything like that. And Nixon has got to deal with this Vietnam War. And he's run on an aggressive, tough stance against communism, everything like that. And Nixon's vice president is Gerald Ford, who will later become president when Nixon is impeached. He's forced out of office because of the Watergate scandal. But Nixon is president, and we are entering the 1970s now. His policy eventually becomes what's called Vietnamization. Vietnamization is the United States will slowly back out of this war and leave it to the South Vietnamese to fight on their own. Now, how successful this was going to be is very, very questionable, because the United States got into the war because the South Vietnamese could not at all fight on their own. So this is really not a reasonable strategy, but it would at least allow the United States to save face. We can leave. Okay, this is your problem. We've supported you, and we can leave. What happens is, though, and by the way, he starts pulling out massive amounts of troops from Vietnam. So that's fine. Remember, there were many hundreds of thousands of troops in Vietnam after a certain point. There were over 500,000 American troops in Vietnam, and Nixon started to scale it down. He took out about 100,000, maybe more, and then he announced he would take out another 150,000. So the country is kind of placated here. The anti-war people, they're settling for this. You know, okay, we're doing this a little bit at a time. It's going to end soon. And mind you, one of the reasons it was so unpopular is because of the draft. I maybe should have mentioned this. You see, people were really, really against this because anytime they might be called and sent to war in this horrible situation and everything like that. That's why so many young people were against the war and everything, because they might be forced to go and sign and fight in this. Now, after this Vietnam War, the United States stopped using the draft because we saw it really didn't work. If people don't sign up to be there, they don't want them. They don't want them because it's going to be a huge problem here. And, you know, this is not a class on the Vietnam War or anything, but there's been a lot of critiques about how it was conducted. Okay, let's be fair. When we draft people, you only have to go for 1 year. You know, just like if you serve on jury duty, that's it. They can't call you for another year. You have to be a limited amount of time where they can obligate you to do something for the government. And here with the draft, okay, 1 year and that's it. Well, the critique was, once somebody learned the country, you know, learned how to fight and learned the country of Vietnam and everything, they were sent home and replaced with someone new. So you constantly had a bunch of new people coming in, just like at your work. Somebody whose first day it isn't going to be very helpful. They might even be a liability. So that was another critique of how the Vietnam War was being run. There were other things going on, McNamara's Whiz Kids and stuff like that. The people here back home were trying to come up with all these theories and ways to fight the war, which really weren't practical. Too many academics influencing things. So that was that. At the same time, though, with Nixon's policy of Vietnamization, which was pleasing the country, and they were satisfied with it. Okay, we're not out of the war yet, but we're moving further toward that. Nixon bombed neighboring Cambodia. It was a secret bombing campaign, and then even an invasion when it looked like this neighboring Cambodia was going communist. You see, one of the biggest reasons, if not the biggest reason, why we got into Vietnam is this idea of the domino theory, that like dominoes, when one falls, it's going to take the next one down, the next one down, the next one down, and that we had this idea if Vietnam fell, if Vietnam went communist, the neighboring countries would also go communist, that they would expand and take over more and more and more area, and we had to put a stop to it. So here, when it looked like this neighboring country, Cambodia, not Vietnam, but right next to Vietnam, was going to go communist, Nixon bombed it and did all kinds of stuff, and that renewed the protests against this war, against the president, against the country, really. People were turning against, Americans were turning against America itself. Now, Nixon also very significantly, Richard Nixon, he tried diplomatic means to address this Vietnam War and in general the communist threat. Nixon, who had been extremely anti-communist and extremely tough on the communists taking over China and everything like that, Nixon actually went to China and made trade agreements with them, and even it was a start of eventually establishing regular diplomatic relations. And Nixon had been against even recognizing the Red Chinese as leaders of China. But now he even agreed to support the admission of China to the United Nations instead of Taiwan. You know, China was a part of the United Nations, and when the communists took over mainland China and the anti-communists went to Taiwan, Taiwan was accepted as the representative of China, the true government, let's say. But now Nixon is saying, no, we'll support the Red Chinese who have taken over mainland China as the people who should be representing China in the United Nations. So this was a whole 180 degrees, and there's a famous saying, only Nixon could go to China. Only Nixon could go to China. Only somebody who was so anti-China and so anti-communist and had the credentials over a long period of time, only someone like him could make peace, and then the people would accept it. Okay, he's not a wimp. He's not backing down. He's not selling out, everything like that, because he was the strongest proponent of going against the Red Chinese, the communist Chinese. So only someone like that could actually say, yeah, we really need to make peace. This is the right thing to do. And it wouldn't be viewed as some sort of weakness. Nixon actually goes to the Soviet Union. He goes to the Soviet Union and starts to create some sort of treaty, basically an arms limitation treaty. We call it SALT, Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. And it's basically to limit the use of nuclear weapons. And this really started to create a time of détente, which means basically the tensions were reduced, and it was aggression between the two was diminishing and diminishing and diminishing. So Nixon really did a lot of impressive stuff. What about Vietnam? Well, say what you will about the bombings and everything like that, but it did probably help speed the negotiations with a kind of a carrot and the stick approach, if you guys have ever heard of that. On one hand you have consequences, on the other hand you have agreement, the reward of peace. So when you have the stick, it actually helps people accept the carrot, which is the reward of peace. And in Colombia and places like that, they have a saying, either silver or lead. You either take the silver, like take bribe money, or you get lead, which are bullets. You get killed. So that's the type of approach that often works well in business or what have you. Now, again, what this resulted in is these Paris peace accords. Basically a ceasefire until there could be free elections, which would decide how the country would be run. And then and all American forces would leave, and all American prisoners of war, called POWs, held by the North Vietnamese, would be released, returned to America, and over 500 of them were prisoners of war. But a little bit later, you know, we had our American embassy in the capital of South Vietnam. But in 1975, early in 1975, the North Vietnamese broke the truce and invaded, and they took city after city after city. And the signal went out to evacuate over the radio, all Americans to evacuate, and it was pretty crazy. Helicopters lifting people off our embassy to evacuate them as fast as possible. And that was it. South Vietnam surrendered, and North Vietnam took over the entire country. And the Vietnamese, for the first time, were in charge of their country. Unfortunately, it was the communist Vietnamese which were in charge of their own country. And there were all kinds of things that maybe I spent a little longer on this Vietnam War than might be warranted, but actually it was really, really significant in American history, much more so than the Korean War, and just events that went on around it about how to deal with these governments being propped up by America, which are corrupt, which the people are not necessarily in favor of. I mean, you look at Afghanistan, you look at Iraq, you see things about leaking, you know, classified information. One of your textbook terms was Pentagon Papers. What's that about? Well, this guy Daniel Ellsberg, who worked on this study, there was a massive study about our American involvement in Vietnam from the end of World War II to that time. I forget what it was, 1967, something like that. This guy Ellsberg, who originally was in favor of involvement in Vietnam, he saw in this study, you know, all this bad stuff, everything that was going on, and he secretly photocopied it and gave it to the New York Times, which is a major, major paper even today. And the Supreme Court, when President Nixon tried to prevent its publication, the Supreme Court said, no, you have not met your burden of proof. You, the government, have not met your burden of proof. And they allowed the New York Times to publish it. And that had a big impact, the Pentagon Papers, but it also had a big impact on freedom of the press. That yes, the media is allowed to publish information even when it's classified government secrets, everything like that. So now Nixon was removed from office because he was caught doing a number of inappropriate things, and specifically there was this Watergate hotel with a break-in and everything like that, and you can read about that if you want. But anyway, he was out of office. His vice president Gerald Ford took over. Gerald Ford did not run on his own. He finished Nixon's presidency. Part of which is he wasn't very popular because he pardoned Nixon. Rather, Nixon, see, impeachment is just when the president is accused of something. But then there's going to be a trial and he may be found guilty and even sent to prison or whatever it is. But Nixon resigned, and then Ford, before there was any trial or anything, pardoned Nixon. And he was very unpopular for that. But over time, people started to think, you know, maybe he was right, that the country didn't need a whole big trial and this and that. It had already been damaged enough. And again, people wanted something completely the opposite now. This you'll see this pattern over and over again. The pendulum swings the opposite way. They voted in a man named Jimmy Carter, a man of great personal morals and everything like that, even after he lost when he ran for re-election. But still, 1977 to 1981, Jimmy Carter was president. And he did all kinds of unusual things. He would carry his own bags. He would, all kinds of things. And after he was president, he was created Habitat for Humanities, where people go and volunteer, and they build homes for people who need them. And he personally helps build them. So he's a man of very good morals and everything like that, and that's what the country wanted after this Nixon scandal was horrendous for the country. If you want to read about the Watergate and everything like that, you're welcome to do that. But you know, moving on to coverage of these wars, after Jimmy Carter, now a lot of problems occurred under his watch. It's not that he did a terrible job, in my opinion. But what happened is lots of things went wrong, specifically in the Middle East. There was this revolution in Iran. A lot of them took people. Some people in Iran stormed our embassy and took them hostage. And this just went on day after day, month after month, with our people in this embassy, which is supposed to be sacred. It's you're not allowed to attack an embassy for any reason. And Carter couldn't get them out. Then there was also runaway, that stagflation, which I mentioned in a previous lecture. Runaway inflation and stagnation. And it happened on Jimmy Carter's watch, and he couldn't stop it. So people wanted something the opposite direction. They were tired of this kind of thing, so Democrat Jimmy Carter lost to Republican Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was, I mentioned to you about Reaganomics and things like that, and his message very much resonated with the people, whereas Carter would say things that were somewhat depressing, that maybe America's time at the top has passed. You know, I give Carter credit for speaking honestly out of what he felt, but, you know, that's not what America wanted to hear, and it turned out not to be correct, not at all correct. Reagan would say, our best days are not behind us. Are they, you know, a very hopeful, joyful message, and he ran for two terms, and under his watch, the Soviet Union collapsed, partly because Reagan, he spent massively on the military. Under his administration, the debt and deficits went way up. You know, Republicans are supposed to not be like that. They're supposed to be very fiscally conservative, and Democrats, they're the ones who are supposed to be loose with the money and everything. But for the military, Reagan really spent a ton of money, and it's basically the Soviet Union. You know, communism is not showing itself to be a very effective economic system to govern a country when implemented over a country. It's essentially the Soviet Union went bankrupt. They just could not keep up, especially because Ronald Reagan had this one program, Star Wars. What is that? Well, you had the Star Wars movie that came out, and so they kind of named it after it. It's this satellite system which would shoot lasers and knock out any missiles, any nuclear missiles coming at us. And it looks like there was no chance it could have worked. But this mere proposal, the Soviet Union just gave up. They said, there's no way we can match it. There's no way we can spend an amount equal to that to stay even with the Americans. And the Russians, initially they started opening up with these two ideas. One was glasnost, which is a Russian word for openness. And another one was perestroika, which is a Russian word for restructuring, which allowed some free enterprise and things like that. But here, in 1991, basically the Soviet Union was just completely dissolved. It fell apart and collapsed for the reasons I explained. And it's interesting because we had said, okay, now you see this communism doesn't work. Now let's go capitalism. And now your economy is really going to pick up. Well, it didn't. The Russians tried to go straight capitalist and everything like that, but it didn't work. I'm not going to say it was a complete failure, but it didn't work. It was unsuccessful, to say the least. What happened? Well, it seems as though, you know, because capitalism depends on individual initiative, entrepreneurship, that kind of bold decision-making, and because the Russians had, for all of their lives, for basically about 50 years, over 50 years, been under communism, where you're not allowed to take initiative, you're not allowed to be entrepreneurial, everything like that, it just was unsuccessful. And the people who took over, now I've told you about aristokratia, aristocracy, democracy, all these types of things. Russia became what's called a kleptocracy. Klepto means stealing. So a kleptomaniac can't help stealing. A kleptocracy, a government of thieves, where the gangsters literally were running the country. Russia, this is not some little third world two-bit country. Russia, these people took it over, and sometimes they're called oligarchs, you know, these very wealthy Russians and everything, but that's what happened. And they're running the country, stealing everything they had and everything that was out there. And the Chinese, who were communists, were watching all of this. And they knew, you know what, this communist thing isn't working so well. And they were watching very carefully how it worked, how Russia was doing things. And they saw, okay, immediately switching over is not a good idea. And the Chinese learned from that. And instead of immediately switching over, they slowly switched over to capitalism. In fact, in name, the Chinese are communists, still communists. But they've switched over more and more toward capitalism over years and, in fact, decades. And now they're basically capitalists. They're totalitarian capitalists, but still. And Russia, what happened there? Just so you know, just to bring us up to the current leader of Russia, Vladimir Putin. These Russian gangsters were fierce. Okay, we think our mafia is bad, the Italian mafias and everything like that. In Russia, they are even far more vicious, far more ruthless. However, there was one group in Russia even more ruthless and more vicious and more powerful than the Russian gangsters. Who were they? The former KGB. The KGB was the Russian version of the CIA. And they were out of work, and they weren't getting paid, and they were seeing what was going on, and, oh, okay, this is a free-for-all. Everybody's doing whatever they want. Okay, we're going to show you how tough you really are. And the KGB fought with the Russian gangsters, and they took over. And Vladimir Putin, he is a former KGB person. And if any of you know who the leader of Russia is Vladimir Putin. And he's president, but he's basically in total control of Russia. Even when he, you know, he wasn't able to run every term and he stepped down for a little while, he just had his guy, Medvedev, in office as a puppet, as his puppet. And then Putin came back. Many people say Vladimir Putin is the richest man in the world, because of all the hundreds of billions of dollars he's taken out of Russia. He is secretly the wealthiest man in the world. And he's, okay, that's Vladimir Putin right there. Now, getting back to this thing. Okay, the Soviet Union fell apart. Fine. Ronald Reagan finishes his second term. Reagan's vice president was George Herbert Walker Bush. And he wins. He wins election. Now, he was the 41st president of the United States, and if you know, I mean, his son, George W. Bush, so George Bush Sr., George Herbert Walker Bush, and his son's name is George Walker Bush, and George Walker Bush one as the 43rd president. And since they both have the same name, people tend to differentiate them by saying Bush 41, meaning George Herbert Walker, the 41st president. Or they'll say Bush 43, which is his son, George Walker Bush Jr., basically. But anyway, George Herbert Walker Bush, Reagan's vice president, then becomes president on his own. He wins election on his own. What happened during his presidency in 1990, August of 1990, the dictator of Iraq, president for life, Saddam Hussein, sent troops, massive amounts of troops, into its neighbor, Kuwait, in the Middle East. So if you look at the Middle East, you have this area here with these big countries, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, this, that. Iraq neighbors Kuwait. In fact, Kuwait used to be a part of Iraq until it was separated. And that was part of the justification for Saddam Hussein invading it, saying, no, no, this is really meant to be our land. Another accusation they made is that the Kuwaitis were slant drilling, which is where you drill kind of at an angle, so to speak. And it's a way to take oil from kind of a neighboring field. There's this movie, There Will Be Blood, where the main character is explaining this. I drink your milkshake by putting his straw in someone else's milkshake, along with the other guy's straw, and showing that, look, even though I'm drinking from my side, I'm really draining from your side as well. So that was the pretext, that was the excuse for invading neighboring Kuwait, which is a fairly wealthy country because of its oil. Now, president at the time, Bush 41, he was actually very knowledgeable about foreign policy. Very, very knowledgeable. I think he did everybody said he did an amazingly good job in this, what would become known as the Persian Gulf War, or the Gulf War for short. And what eventually came about is called Operation Desert Storm. And it was largely initially an air war where we took down his air force and everything like that, and then we sent in our land troops. And all this was being watched on the news. You know, CNN, you guys might not know this, but there didn't used to be 24-hour news until a man named Ted Turner formed CNN, the first ever 24-hour news network. And that seems kind of strange at the time. I mean, that seemed kind of unthinkable. How are you going to air news 24 hours a day? But he proved it could work. And this really boosted their ratings a lot, because every day we'd be watching these what are called Patriot missiles, used against the enemy. And you saw the land war, which didn't last very long. Once our troops went in, Iraq quickly surrendered, and the whole war was over with only, you know, less than 1,000 Americans killed. This is a pretty big war, and less than 1,000 Americans were killed. Huge success. Whole world is looking at us because George W. Bush 41, he again was very knowledgeable about foreign policy and foreign affairs, and he made a huge coalition of dozens of nations, big nations, to go in together to stop this aggression. And they did it together, and they did it successfully. Now, actually, when they repelled Saddam Hussein's forces out of Kuwait, a lot of people said, no, he made a mistake. Bush 41 made a mistake by not going all the way to Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, eliminating Saddam Hussein, changing the regime, everything like that. In fact, that's one of the reasons that Bush 41 lost re-election. Now, mind you, he was really, really popular after the Gulf War. I mean, extraordinarily popular. But some things happened. I mean, one of them was he had campaigned on this pledge. He said, read my lips, no new taxes. And Republicans tend to be really against taxes. But he raised taxes. Now, that turned out to be the right thing to do, But he lost re-election because people didn't like it. He didn't go all the way to Baghdad and everything like that. And mind you, a lot of times, just like you know in life, gratitude and positive feelings can be very temporary, can be very fleeting. Remember what Machiavelli said? Whether it's better to be loved or feared? Well, it's best to be both, but if you can only be one, you should be feared, because when people love you, they do what they want, what you want, when they feel like it. So yeah, Bush was people loved Bush right after the war, but that feeling faded. And then they were thinking, oh, you know what? He didn't do such a good job in that he didn't go all the way into Iraq. Well, and people thought that for a long time, until his son, Bush 43, went all the way into Iraq. Hey, yeah, job's finally done. Well, it turned out, and by the way, when Bush 43 was planning this invasion of the later invasion of Iraq, which we're still in now, Bush Sr. Put the word out. He didn't do it directly, but he put the word out. This is not a good idea. You should not be doing this. This is a mistake. But the son, no, he knew so much and everything like that, and his advisors told him, yeah, you have to do this, and went in, and we're still there to this day. But anyway, people felt that Bush Sr., Bush 41, should have gone all the way to Iraq, and that's one of the reasons why he lost re-election. Bill Clinton was president after George Bush, after Bush 41. Now, Bill Clinton did serve two terms and no major wars during his time, but he also got impeached. So it was Andrew Johnson got impeached, if you saw from the beginning of the semester, Chapter 15. Richard Nixon. Now, Nixon didn't officially get impeached, but he was, you know, it's just a way of speaking. Maybe I should have phrased it differently earlier. I'm kind of compressing a huge amount of information here. Nixon resigned before they could officially impeach him, but the impeachment got him out, is what I meant to say. And he would not only have been impeached, he would have been convicted. But so Nixon removed for impeachment. Basically, impeachment got him out, even though he wasn't officially impeached. He resigned ahead of time. Bill Clinton. People were saying he should resign. He's definitely going to get out. What did he do? Well, he was under investigation for a whole lot of different things. You know, the Republicans kept investigating a lot of suspicious stuff with the Clintons. In the course of those investigations, in a seemingly unrelated thing, this issue with him and a woman named Monica Lewinsky came up, and he said under oath, you know, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. And then evidence came up that he actually did. And so they impeached Bill Clinton for perjury, which is lying under oath. But he was not convicted, and actually people supported him more when these impeachment hearings went forward. But anyway, that was Bill Clinton, and he ran for two terms, and his vice president was Al Gore. So in 2001, Al Gore ran for office, and Bush Sr.'s son, George W. Bush, people also refer to him as W, or George W. Bush. What happened is, it was a very close election, as I said, with the earlier test term, Gore v. Bush, right? It came down to Florida, and it came down to the razor's edge here in Florida during the recounts and everything like that. Any of you who are old enough to remember, that was yet another embarrassment for Florida, yet another time when we embarrassed ourselves in front of the whole country. But anyway, you see, it came down really, really close. It was the closest presidential election in American history, and still is. The closest possible election. But what happened is, it was decided that George W. Bush is the person who won, and he became president. Fine. There had been, under earlier presidencies, certain terrorist attacks against the U.S. Navy ship, the Cole, C-O-L-E, some U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and a car bomb. This was in 1993, in the garage of the World Trade Center in New York City. And this had been intended to take down the World Trade Center. Ideally, they were hoping to knock one building into the other and take them both down, but it did not work. I mean, it was bad, but it did not do nearly the damage that they had hoped it would. Now we're in 2001. George W. Bush is president. That morning, September 11th, 2001, everybody remembers where they were when they learned about what happened. I remember where I was. Everybody knows what happened because America had had peace for so long. If you guys only knew what America was like before September 11th, I mean, this is you're crazy. Just a permanent state of war you guys have lived in, but it wasn't like this. You know, this is an abnormal situation that we're living through. Anyway, September 11th, early morning. A plane is hijacked and crashed into one of the World Trade Centers. About 15 minutes later, people are wondering, news is wondering, is this a, what happened? Goodness, is this a catastrophe? Could this be terrorism? Well, about 15 minutes after the first plane hit, a second plane hit the other World Trade Center. And clearly, this is obviously some terrorist attack. A little bit later, not even an hour later, a third plane crashed into the Pentagon. The Pentagon is our center which organizes our American military. There was even a fourth plane that got hijacked, and it was heading toward Washington. We think we're pretty sure it was either toward the Capitol building or the White House. We're still not sure, at least last I checked. And so four planes were hijacked by these, by somebody. It was somebody who did it. We didn't know who. And what actually happened with this fourth plane is it got delayed a little bit. It was meant to be basically simultaneous attacks. But the fourth plane, for whatever reason, I don't remember exactly, it didn't take off in time. And when they were in the air, what happened is, okay, they got hijacked and rerouted and everything like that by these hijackers. But, you know, even back then, a lot of people had cell phones. And because it got delayed, the other terrorist attacks had already occurred. And as people on this fourth plane are communicating with their family or whatever it is, oh, we've been hijacked or whatever, their family members are texting them back, no, this is not just a hijacking. They're crashing the planes all across the country. They're going to kill you, and they're going to kill a bunch of other people as well. And so this fourth plane said, you know what, we don't have a choice. We have to fight. And they fought for the plane. And unfortunately, they died. The plane crashed, but it crashed before it could reach the target, whatever that might be. So this September 11th, whenever somebody says September 11th, this is what they're talking about. And we were quickly able to discern who it was. It was the same person behind those other terrorist attacks I just mentioned. His name was Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden. Now, he was a very wealthy Saudi man, part of the family of Saud. That's why it's called Saudi Arabia. This family took it over, and it's an Arab area, and their name is Saud, so they called it Saudi Arabia. And he's one of their family, but it's a gigantic family with hundreds of members. And he had major problems with America, especially with our support of Israel, with our way of life, but in particular, he had a problem with when we went in with that Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War, which I told you about. We stayed. We kicked Saddam Hussein out, but then we stayed rather than leaving. And this really upset him. There should not be, you know, foreign troops on our soil, non-Muslim troops, everything like that. They need to get out. And that's what bin Laden wanted. And he was a part of this group, Al-Qaeda, which means from the base. Remember, I gave you the, I might have mentioned this, but in the history of last names, I had told you about different ways to put, to say son of. Like in Spanish, it's putting EZ on the end of the father's first name. In English, you put son on the father's first name and whatever. In Arabic, you put Al. So Al means son of or from, and Qaeda means base. So they call themselves of the base, of the majority of people. In the same way, the Russians, I told you, they call themselves Bolsheviks, one of the majority. Whether it's true or not, they want to associate themselves as representing the masses. So Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, you see, we knew he had attacked us before. And he was, I believe, hiding in Kenya originally. That was his base. And we pressured the Kenyans to kick him out. And he went to another place, really, really in the middle of nowhere, called Afghanistan. Afghanistan, and it had an extremist Muslim group called the Taliban. The Taliban was an extremist Muslim group in Afghanistan, which had ruled the country for a number of years, and they were harboring bin Laden. Now, we told the Afghan government, hand over bin Laden. Give him to us or we're going to invade. The Taliban refused, the Taliban government of Afghanistan. And partly we do have to understand culture. This is a huge, huge thing in Arab culture. If someone comes to you for refuge, you take them in, no matter what. Now, it was, they didn't have to take bin Laden in. But once they did, and he did his thing, they couldn't hand him over. Now, the Taliban were bad people, definitely. I'm not trying to defend them, but it's this really big thing in Arab culture that you cannot, you know, you have to have this hospitality. And you understand why that evolved in that harsh desert climate. You know, somebody comes to you, you need to give them shelter. Otherwise, they'll die a horrible death. So that's how that culture evolved over thousands of years, and that's still there. They would not hand bin Laden over. And so we invaded Afghanistan. Well, the world was pretty much supporting us. Okay, you know, they attacked you. You know, we understand. But then we also attacked Iraq. And the reasons for that were kind of jumbled up that were given. And mind you, you have the war in Afghanistan, which is one of your textbook terms. So that's how that got started. And then you have the Iraq War, which is another one of your textbook terms. And the Gulf War was also an earlier textbook term. There were various reasons given, as I said, for why we went to war in Iraq, but really that many, many people inside this country and especially outside of it were against this Iraq war. Bush 43 built a coalition, but far smaller and far less enthusiastic than the one his father had built. Because again, people were asked, why on earth are you going to war with Iraq? They didn't attack you. And the main reason given was that Iraq was developing these weapons of had weapons of mass destruction. And to be fair, many countries said, yes, he has weapons of mass. Saddam Hussein, who was still left in power, as I said, Bush Sr. didn't take him out. And by the way, another reason, I maybe should have brought this up earlier, but another reason why Bush Sr. didn't take him out is because he was smart. He understood international affairs and everything, and Iran was a big threat to us. And Iraq and Iran have hated each other for a long time, and he wanted to have a balance of power. That's a big thing in foreign relations. You want one side to counterbalance another, otherwise you're going to be fighting everyone everywhere. And there's more subtle explanations for that as well, but that's essentially the case. You leave one power in there, Iraq, to keep Iran from expanding too much. And when we went into this Iraq war, that's when Iran really got a huge amount of influence and power and strength in the area, because Iraq was no longer there to counterbalance them. It is a complex situation. I'm not going to get into it. I'm about to end this lecture. But you really should know why we're in these wars. And the big reason given for the Iraq War was that he had these weapons of mass destruction. And there seemed to be Saddam Hussein himself said, yes, he had weapons of mass destruction, but he was lying. We think just because he wanted to intimidate anybody from taking over, any invaders from invading his country, or maybe he thought it would even deter us. Probably he thought it would help him stay in power and prevent him from being overthrown internally. But for whatever reason, that, you know, he would say that the evidence seemed to support, yes, there were weapons of mass destruction. There was an informant, a codenamed Curveball, I mean, that should have been a tip, saying, yes, Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, so we went to war in Iraq. We quickly found out, no, they did not have weapons of mass destruction. But as Colin Powell said, Colin Powell was this American general, very famous, and he was against it for a long time. Finally, he wound up supporting it, but he was really against it, and he said, you break it, you bought it. He said, Pottery Barn rules. You break it, you bought it. Apparently, Pottery Barn doesn't have that rule, but he just said that. And we broke it. We broke Iraq. It turned out to be correct what he said. We got stuck there. And also, we split our focus in two different directions. Had we gone into Afghanistan immediately, we would have gotten bin Laden. Had we put all our forces there, but we didn't. We let him escape. We moved too slowly. Even though we went into Afghanistan first, we didn't go in with enough force and enough speed to catch bin Laden. We would have, but he escaped through the mountains. I believe it was through the mountains. And it took us years and years and years. Bush 43 never caught him. Barack Obama, under his administration, we finally got bin Laden and killed him in his hideout. He was hiding out in Pakistan, of all places. But even though we went into Afghanistan in 2001 to get bin Laden, and about 10 years later we did get him in 2011, and now it's about 10 years after that, we are still in Afghanistan. And for that matter, we're still in Iraq. Now, mind you, the troop presence over the last couple of years has been reduced to only a few thousand troops in each of those countries, American troops, but still, it's a significant thing which we're tied into and still grappling with. And everything is everything. And that's what it is. You see all throughout history these situations have come up. That's why I told you that phrase, holding a tiger by the ears. You don't want to hold on, but you don't want to let go. Because everything is they have these phrases and these terms because the situations repeat over and over and over again. As I say, not just on an international level or a national level or a state or a social level with a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a financial situation or an academic situation or whatever it is. You see, you know, that Truman quote, the only thing new in the world is the history you do not know. And Churchill said something similar. The further backward you can look, the further forward you can see. Because these are the types of things. Even in this class, our very first chapter was on Reconstruction, right? Just like we're trying to reconstruct the Afghan government and the Iraq government, we've been trying for a long time. We tried to reconstruct the government of the South. And we put in big military troops, you know, big numbers, a huge amount of money, all this kind of stuff, and we were there year after year after year until finally, and same thing, they had their terrorist organization, not Al-Qaeda, like in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they had the Ku Klux Klan in the South. But still, you know, eventually we in the North said, you know what, it's too much. We've been there for too long, we need to pull out. That's what it is. Where do you draw the line? And history informs these decisions. Donald Trump has been trying to get out the remaining troops and has said, no, our troops will be home by Christmas. This was a few years ago. Things like that. And even in his last little over a month in office, he is having the troops in Iraq reduced from 3,000 to 2,500. Okay, that's pretty small change. And in Afghanistan from 4,500 to 2,500. Against the military advisors' suggestions and everything like that, they say this is dangerous, this is risky. So again, what is the future going to hold? And especially now with Joe Biden taking over in January, what is he going to do? And how are these decisions going to affect his policies? As I say, you know, that you can even look in the Bible. That's how old these principles are. In Ecclesiastes, they have this famous quote, "The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun." That's, I mean, people in America, we abbreviate it, ain't nothing new under the sun. You know, it's all happened before. However, there's this other famous quote by Aldous Huxley. I mean, there's variants on it by different people, but that men do not learn very much from the lessons of history is the most important of all the lessons of history. So hopefully this class will help you with that, because these in everything you look at day by day, everything, these principles apply. You know, what a tragedy if things had just gone a little differently. If you guys, you know, it's hard for me to wrap my head around it, that you guys weren't born during a time when America was not at war. Here, these forever wars. And if you only knew what America was like before that, before we went in, especially going into Iraq, man, that cost so much for this country. We lost our international reputation, took a bad hit because Iraq didn't attack us. We basically invaded a sovereign country without justification. The world understood why we invaded Afghanistan. But Iraq, so that was bad, and then it went really badly. We got stuck there. We couldn't make any progress. How many lives have been lost? How much money has been spent? Our adversaries, you never used to hear this stuff. North Korea, Iran, all these different countries which are really dangerous right now, even China, at least economically, they wouldn't have dared until we got stuck in Afghanistan and Iraq. That was really a major turning point. And you know, my favorite line of poetry, which certainly applies to many things in life, whether it's you know, bad financial investment or whatever it might be. "Of all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest of these, it might have been." But, you know, hopefully this class will help you, and you will be better able to learn from history, your own history, and the country's history, and the world's history, and hopefully your life will be better for it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Bye-bye.